Jesus was a working man and a hero you will hear. Born in the town of Bethlehem at the turning of the year, at the turning of the year.
And welcome to Here We Stand. I'm your host, Kevin Ann at Eagle Strong Voice. Welcome. The Song of the Carpenter, the Ballad of the Carpenter by Phil Oakes, that goes out to my dear sister Gil in England, who loves that song, as do I. It was a request, so there you go, Gil. I know it's late for you, but I love you. Last week we ended with a question, if not now, when? If not you, then who? This is especially important as we come into April, because the campaign to hold criminal churches accountable, and that's an interesting idea, whether they can ever be held accountable. It's our job to stop these crimes against children on the ground. We've talked about this campaign. It's the week of April 14th to 21st. If you want information about how to be involved, and there are a lot more people these days getting involved, contact thecommonland@gmail.com. We'll send you out a whole kit of petitions, leaflets, stickers, all sorts of things. So pick up the struggle where you are, brothers and sisters. Our special guest today is Deborah. She's an insider, former member of the Latter-day Saints, LDS, or Mormon Church in Salt Lake City. She has some very horrendous things to share about her own personal experiences, but also the great knowledge and strength she has gained in confronting these crimes in the Mormon Church. Before that, we've got some updates. And again, you can follow all our work, murderbydecree.com, including the updates and postings from the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State, right there at murderbydecree.com. Now, first of all, you've had a lot of reports in the media about this thing that's going on in Rockland County, where we really call it medical apartheid. Children and teenagers are now banned from the streets of Rockland County unless they have been vaccinated. Now, get this. This was in the New York Times last Wednesday. Rockland County to ban children with no measles vaccine from public. Now, according to the New York Times article, out of a county population of over 300,000, there's only 48 cases this year. And yet, despite that, children are banned from schools unless they're vaccinated. They can't even appear in public. And their parents could go to jail for 6 months or get a $500 fine if they don't vaccinate their kids. Interesting figures, because that same punishment, 6 months in jail or $500 fine, that's what Aboriginal parents faced if they didn't cart their children into the death camps of the residential schools, where half of them never came back. Interesting analogy. But this is an amazing article, because nowhere in it did they talk about a constitutional challenge to a clear attack on the basic civil liberties of Americans. And no one in government, no civil rights lawyer anywhere is objecting to this, which I find very interesting and telling. Obviously, this is coming from the highest level of power. And it's also interesting that the Pediatric and Association of America just made a motion 2 weeks ago to remove the religious exemption from vaccinations. Up to now, if you had religious scruples about having your kids vaccinated, that was reason enough to not have them done. Now that's gone, or will be gone, if the medical establishment get their way. And it's interesting, they say in the article that most of these measles outbreaks is occurring among the Orthodox Jewish community in Rockland County, which is just over the Hudson River from New York. It's interesting that in Penn Yan, New York, the Mennonite community, another exclusive religious community, was just targeted last month, in which their midwives were arrested and prohibited from delivering birth and requiring that over 200 Mennonite kids get vaccinated. So I believe this is part of a bigger agenda to target any, not just religious, but any separatist community that's not part of the grid, that's not part of this corporate system. Clearly they're being targeted right now, and I believe that that's what this latest abomination going on in Rockland County is all about. Now, it relates into the today's interview because, of course, the LDS, the Mormon Church, is heavily invested in Big Pharma, and you know, we're going to talk a little bit about that, the drug testing that's gone on, you know, among Mormons and that kind of thing. Clearly, as with the Vatican Bank and the Church of Rome, there's that Big Pharma link to the churches. It's interesting, Big Pharma, like Eli Lilly and other pharmaceutical companies, are part of what's called the Fund for Theological Education, where they actually fund the seminaries that train clergy. And that's been going on for a long time. Basically, what we found out is that in exchange for getting money from Big Pharma, the churches hand over their own kids, orphans in Catholic orphanages, kids in residential schools, hand them over for drug testing. That's been going on for well over a half century, actually more like a century. Now, finally, in another thing in the news that we wanted to mention, the recent, and this has been, of course, an issue for some of us, the so-called International Tribunal of Natural Justice, which has been trying, two of their people at least, have been trying to get yours truly put away in the slammer for some reason. There's been interesting research done by one of our Dutch journalists who's come up with some interesting facts about the ITNJ that people should know about, and this is what I'll finish on before bringing Deborah on. The so-called International Tribunal of Natural Justice is not a public inquiry. It is, according to its own website, of the legal arm of something called Humanitad. Now, Humanitad is a private organization set up by Sacha Stone. That's not actually his real name. He's the son of an English lord who worked for the Rockefeller Foundation. They're also very heavily connected with the crime family called the Orsinis. The Orsinis go back many centuries. Orsinis have been popes, cardinals, very high in the Vatican establishment. They're connected directly to the Ninth Circle. And Sacha Stone was a good friend of somebody called Ciro Orsini, who funded his organization and is directly tied in with the Orsini Mafia family. So it's interesting, these connections that develop. When you look into this, the Humanitad, which set up the ITNJ, is directly tied to the UN Agenda 21 on sustainability. So folks who give their testimony, you have to remember, ask the simple question, where are you getting your money from? What are your ties? That was information going out, especially to folks in Europe who are also being targeted by the ITNJ recently. And that link between the Orsini Vatican family and the fact that I was attacked by ITNJ after bringing out this link between the Mormon Church and the Vatican, no coincidence there, folks. Again, if you've got any comments or more information, write to us, thecommonland@gmail.com. Now, let's bring on Deborah. Hello, Deborah. Are you there?
Hi, I'm here. How are you, Kevin?
I'm doing really well. It's good to have you with us. And I wondered if you give a little bit of a background about who you are exactly and some of the stuff you want to talk to us today about.
Wow. I was born and raised in the LDS Church. I've had family that goes back generations and generations with this church. There's pioneer heritage there. So there's a lot of history that comes in through my line. I was not just born and raised. I was actually, my marriage was also in the LDS Church, so it was started there. And the way that I actually had been raised was to really be completely immersed in the religion. And so with my experiences and the way I was living my life, I really was what is considered a true believer. This is definitely something that I invested my life in, I ingested, I was really reasoning my life with and navigating my life with. And I felt really good about that. There were some things that I, called into question occasionally, but I also was very well trained in as the whole community and worldwide society of the Mormon churches is like, you really don't have anything above the authorities, which is the prophet, president of the church, and the general authorities. And so my experience was really trying to, my desire was to be very in alignment with that and faithful to that, because I had, I really did believe that that was the right way to live. And so with that, I raised my family that way. Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. I just think it's really important because of what you're going to be talking about. If it's possible for you to talk about your childhood and the things that happened when you were young.
Absolutely. So we moved around a lot as a child. So I was actually born in Utah, but then from Utah, then had a lot of movement back and forth between different states and in Utah. California was a big place that we ended up living and going back and forth to. But my childhood was really it was split, meaning in the realm of what it was that I was aware of and what I lived on a day to day basis. There was one reality, which is kind of like, you know, mother, father, children. Dad goes to work, mom stays at home, happy family, let's have dinner at 5 kind of idea, and let's take vacations and let's go to school. And so just kind of a normal life. On the other side of that, the dark shadow side was actually a very terrifying experience. So there was incest involved, and it was familial, not just with my father, but there were uncles and grandparents and cousins and all kinds of things that were that way. And then in addition to that, because of the way, at least in my family, children are viewed, they're basically viewed as pawns. And so there was a lot of trading that went on, not just in the family, but outside. So depending on where you ranked or what you were viewed as and the value you were, that kind of determined who you were traded to or how you were traded. And so there was just even within the family and within the community that our family was in, there was a lot of child trafficking that happened. And the trafficking, I think people really kind of feel like it has to go out of state. And really what I consider it is like I was personally sold to a group of men, used for the afternoon, used overnight, whatever, and then interned. That, in my world, qualifies as, you know, human trafficking. I was being sold. I was being traded. I was being used, and you know, as a person that was not a person. I was just a commodity.
Okay. Now, if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about the detail. How old were you, and what happened to you?
You know, one of the most one of the hardest ones for me to really have wrapped my head around was there was this one experience where I was in probably about fifth grade, and I was home. It was after school, and so it was like, you know, fairly early afternoon. And when I came home, my dad was there, and I was kind of surprised that he was home from work. And he said, "Hey, you know what? Why don't you come outside with me?" And I'm like, "Okay." Well, just then this truck pulled up, and it was the kind of truck that I can't remember if it was a bread truck or something, but it was one of those delivery trucks that was kind of an industrial site. So it was not a van, it was an actual truck, but it was a covered vehicle. And I thought that was kind of odd, and the back doors opened up, and three men got out. My dad had grabbed my arm, and I could tell that they were coming at me. So two of them grabbed me, and one of them handed my dad some money, and they actually just kind of swooped me into the truck and put like a big bag, over me, a big flour sack or something. It was cloth and anything. Anyway, I was immediately put into this truck. The doors were closed and off I went for the evening. And I remember hearing very clearly that particular transaction was a $2,000 transaction for my dad. And when, you know, that for some reason just kind of anchored in me, because it was just so bewildering, baffling, and horrific to me. Because then what ensued after that was me being transported to a location. I was drugged, and then there was raping. You know, I was raped a number of times. Occasionally, it was brutal. So I was beaten, and then there was also sacrifice that went on in front of me as well too. So there was a whole system that was in place, and so it was more than just, hey, you know, let me
right.
sell my daughter to you.
It was organized.
A very well organized situation.
And where did this ritual take place, where there was a sacrifice? And can you tell it a little about who sacrificed and who did it?
Okay, so this is really interesting. You're asking me a question about that happens often and in different locations. In this particular case that I'm referring to, It was in a private home's garage. So there was a back building, and it was already set up. So it was a private property. And there were other men that were invited to be there. So it wasn't just the three. Those were the ones that were just actually a part of picking me up as commodity and delivering me.
Sorry, this was in Salt Lake City or nearby?
And this was actually up in Ogden at the time. So Ogden is about an hour away from Salt Lake City. It's a hub for this kind of activity, as is Salt Lake City and some other areas south. So the whole area, as it goes up and down this mountain range of the Wasatch Front, is really really active in the trafficking, in really what it is ritual abuse. And so there's a lot of ritualization, there's a lot of trading, there's a lot of sacrifice, there's a lot of murder. Anything that you can think about that would qualify for it is actually present, is still practiced. And I've had conversation with a small number of people about it. A few of them have had the same situations or the same experiences. And boy, those are careful conversations. When we have those conversations, they're careful. But what we end up discovering is names and places and faces and locations that are very similar. And so even there, when those friendships began, there's still a little bit of tentativeness about, you know, what did happen to you and how much healing have you done? Are you still in contact with those people? It's just very interesting how you have to really protect yourself. But yeah,
I do want to ask you about the details of this sacrifice. But before that, I also want to kind of flag for people that you mentioned at one point that you were actually gifted to a Roman Catholic cardinal who has,
yes.
Well, we can talk about the identity of this man, but this was done by Mormons in Mormon facilities. Is that correct?
Yes, that was it. And that was actually a friend of mine. She and I were talking about
That's right.
So this a girlfriend of mine and I connected a few years ago. And as our friendship has actually developed, we did notice that, you know, we shared a lot of the same situations, a lot of the same ceremonies that we were experiencing. And then she came up with this comment about the Catholic Church, because I actually had an experience in the basement myself of the Cathedral of the Madeleine, which is a major Catholic church here. And she said, oh, well, this is what happened to me, but there was a cardinal present. I'm like, what, like a guy from Rome? And she said, yeah, absolutely. And so then she was telling me about her experience, and it was really thorough. And so, yeah, there was, according to her experience, she was part of a group of, a small group of children, actually, that was present during there was some kind of an agreement, or there was some kind of meeting between top officials with the Catholic Church and with the Mormon Church, and it was done in some secret chambers, and it was, she told me it was down below the temple, or it was down below in some places that are, there's a tunnel system all through Salt Lake. And so somewhere off of that tunnel system is what she recalls what she recalls. I don't know exactly the location. I don't even know if she knows exactly the location, because, you know, the system down there is pretty extensive.
And she said, yeah. I believe she said that she recognized who this cardinal was.
She did. She actually, she had actually told me that she did some investigating, because, you know, we're not, another thing that I share with a lot of, or we did as children, is, you know, the Mormon Church is definitely exclusive in its, what do I want to call it? It is the one true church. So that's something that we're taught. So there wasn't a lot of interest or exposure or even education about other religions. It's just like, no, we're going to convert them, and they need to be Mormon as well. So when she wanted to learn more about what she was seeing and the robes that were there and why did this man have this hat on, and she also knew very clearly that there was, he held the title of cardinal, you know, there, that was kind of important to her. So really what she did is she was looking, she actually just went searching for faces, and because this man had very sharp features and he was very unkind, according to what she was saying, and he had on this black ring. She remembered seeing this ring, and their shoes. He had, you know, some specific, like, soft shoes. It was fascinating, the things that she was remembering, that she was sharing with me as she was telling me about this story. But there was definitely an exchange. There was some documents signed, and there was an exchange of Catholic children and Mormon children. It was kind of some, I don't know, she didn't really explain it. We didn't really go into why there was participation, right, of the children on both sides, but, yeah, you know, we can, yeah, yeah, we could assume, make a pretty easy assumption there.
Who did she think this man was?
She was pretty certain as she was doing her research, and she even pulled up some pictures, and we looked at this together a few years ago, and I was just talking to her about it recently, and she said it was Pope Paul the VI. And
that's
so...
Paul the VI. He was the Pope from 1963 to 78. So this would have happened during that period?
I'm assuming so. She was really trying to, pull together...
The child.
Yeah, some faces. And so, I mean, as she was putting this together, just really in her own way, she kind of pulled it together and said, this is who I think it is. And,
And you said he wore a black ring.
Well, that's what she was saying. Yeah, she was very, very, it was a really, important thing for her to remember.
Yeah, the papal ring is a black ring, yes.
Oh, okay. So then that would be, so that's fascinating to me, because she seemed to be very adamant about, you know, recognizing that there was a ring there. And again, she went looking, like I said, she was very, what she told me at the
amazing
time, she was just really kind of focused on looking for that.
When Russell Nelson met with so-called Pope Francis last month, this month in March, that wasn't the first time, it sounds like. It sounds like there's been a long relationship there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can't tell you from, you know, how high up or how often, but I can say that based on what she was telling me, what her experience was, and then, you know, just even the news that the church likes to put out about how we've got great relations with, you know, different religions, and, you know, communication with how great things are here with the different bishops that are, that are stationed in Salt Lake City. I mean, I think there's one main bishop here, but anyway, the thing is they do really try and say, hey, we're this really loving, inclusive church. And yet I know that, there's been directives even from the pulpit. I remember there was a general conference that I was watching. I was very interested in it. And at the time, I think it was Thomas S. Monson. It was a prophet. And he just, if I recall right, the directive was, you know, love your neighbor, kind of like be nice. But he was basically saying be nice to them, but don't interact with people outside of your religion. Just don't go
right
there.
Right. So it's very strange that kind of exclusive religion would be having that relation. Now,
yeah.
Can you tell us the details? These children not only raped and trafficked between Catholics and Mormons, including top officials, but you said there was human sacrifice and torture going on. Can you describe exactly what you have witnessed?
So there have been a number of times. This is a common practice, and that's one of the things that's so horrific about it is it doesn't, I mean, there have been times that adults have been killed because they've been trying to get out of the cult, out of the deeper part of it, and so they're made an example of.
What kind
when
of
those
example?
Things,
like what happened?
So there would be it's kind of like they find it's a dualistic thing. So if somebody's trying to get away, great, this is going to be a great opportunity for us to bring children or other cult members in to do some deeper conditioning. So we're going to make an example of this person. So then they make it ceremonial where there was this one time I saw this, there's a big group. It was a really big group, and this man, we were told this man was trying to get out of the cult, and apparently he had done something so terrible that they chose to make a public, it was a very, it was a big group. It was on private property. It was in a big clearing. And they had him up on a stand tied to a stake, and they began to skin him alive. And so with that happening in front of everybody, the demonstration was, and it was outside, so it's nerve endings, and I mean, just having the skin filleted would be just excruciating. And later that evening, they allowed that whole process to happen. They were going through their chanting. They were going through the demonstration. Do not try to leave, because this is what will happen to you. And at the end of the whole situation, they did kill him.
Oh, Deborah, when you say skinned alive, mm-hmm. was it done with knives?
Yes. In this case, that particular one, it was Gordon B. Hinckley, Thomas S. Monson, and Boyd K. Packer.
And who are they?
And they were at the time, they were general authorities in the Mormon Church. And they, at this time, all of them have died. But at that time, they were very,
they were
very influential. They were,
yeah.
Yes.
There
wasn't a prophet. They weren't. None of them had been prophet yet, but that was happening. So the system of who was going to be showing up as the president/prophet was already being
right.
lined up for them too.
And there was the fellow who's in now, Russell Nelson, who met in Rome this last month. Did you ever mm-hmm. witness him doing anything?
Yeah, there was. There had been he. Not only me, but a number of people actually have witnessed him. He's a physician, and he's in charge of a lot of the things that happen with abortions, with aborting babies, with drinking blood, eating fetuses, and things like that. So he's really instrumental in having those kinds of things organized, set up, and performed. He's really interested, actually, in how the body, how at the time what I was seeing, how the body heals from, I was seeing an abortion. So what I was witnessing at the time, there was a number of girls in the room. There was one abortion being performed that was a real one. And then the rest of us were being conditioned or we'd already been drugged, we'd been tortured, but the room was full of just this terrible screaming, and each of us had another man at our ear telling us, this is what's going to happen to you. This is what's going to happen to you, get pregnant. And we can take this from you. We can take from your body what you create.
This was something Russell Nelson, the present prophet, was doing?
Correct, yes.
What did you see him do?
Actually, aborting a baby. They were taking, he was in charge of doing the abortion, and the fetus was, it was a small, I just remember thinking, God, that's a small baby, and they actually allowed, they took the baby out of the girl that was pregnant, and she was allowed to bleed, and they killed the baby in front of her and allowed it to bleed. And then really what they were doing is they had other parts of other fetuses that they then made each of us eat, which was ridiculously disgusting. But then, there was blood that we were having to ingest, and she had to do that. And then at the same time, the terrorization of getting pregnant was all about that. And then at the same time, the whole idea of what kind of power this group has over creation is being played out in a really graphic way. So it's like, you know, the other girls, there's it's so graphic because there's blood everywhere. There's nothing about it that's clean. It smells bad. You're drugged. You're not sure it's real. It could be a nightmare, but it's not because you're really experiencing it. And in the meantime, you know, anything that you're realizing, that anything you create can be destroyed.
I wanted to clarify something for people, because we're trying to show the similarities between this and Ninth Circle rituals, which the Catholic Church mm-hmm. does. And, mm-hmm. If I didn't misquote you or reading from my notes, Russell Nelson performed the abortion, cut up the fetus, and then people had to eat the parts and drink the blood?
Yes, as well as the men did as well. But yes, the girls that were all in the room, they cut up the parts and we had to consume them. Yeah, I wanted to throw up. It was absolutely disgusting. But they would hold, they would give us little pieces of the baby. They made sure that we knew that's exactly what it was. We were told you were going to eat it. They force it into our mouths. It was slimy. It was bloody. They would put, you know, I had his hand, the guy that was working on me had his hands over my mouth, and then it was just disgusting. There was entrails, there was muscles, there was organs. And
yeah, but how old were you when this happened?
Chew on that.
How old were you when this?
I was 11.
You were 11. This would have been
11, yeah.
Yeah, somebody, we're talking in the 70s, 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
I also wanted to ask about this Russell Nelson. He's known as somebody who also drugs people. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's drug testing that's gone on. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, your experience?
That's pretty extensive. Yeah, absolutely. So I guess on a simple level, there, anytime anything is going to happen to anybody, you're going to be drugged. There's just no way around it. What they're focusing on is the state of mind. So depending on what it is they're wanting to have happen with your brain function, and the conditioning that's going on, you're either going to be heavily drugged or there's going to be a cocktail that has been administered so that they have complete control over what is going on with the victims, the people, the whatever, that are the children and the adults. It's not just children. You need to understand it is a whole gamut of groupings depending on, you know, what they're after and what the ceremony is about. A lot of it happens with children because when they condition children early, you know, it's already embedded, and then you're easier to control as an adult. So there's always going to be a drugging. But as far as the drug testing goes, there are a number of testing facilities, but the testing facility that I was delivered to, it was a lot of experimentation as far as what kind of combinations can be administered to a human being and what is elicited. So I could be given something that would bring up euphoria, and I could be watching something that I should be completely horrified by, but I'm seeing something that I'm feeling good about.
Right.
Or I could be completely terrorized at the vision of, or the thought of, or the, you know, the seeing Jesus Christ, you know, God, you know, my experience with having and watching Jesus and Satan, you know, kind of role play, and then Jesus always being killed by Satan. That's a common theme, you know, that evil is always vanquishing good. Jesus
is
always dying.
That incident, you saw people dressed up like one Jesus and one is Satan, and Satan defeated Jesus?
Often. And in these many cases, that's part of the ceremony, and that's part of what's going to be the sacrificial part. So the person that is playing the role of Jesus will often be killed. And so part of that role play is it's sword play. And I've seen people drowned. I've seen people stabbed. I've seen people shot. You know, so that role play, it's orchestrated. It's not just like, well, you know, let's just kind of throw this together.
And these killings occurred where? Was it in the temple in Salt Lake City or elsewhere?
Often and elsewhere. It's not something, and I want you to really understand this. People like to say, yeah, oh my gosh, I can't believe it's happening in the basement of the temples or it's happening in the temple. Well, yeah, absolutely, 100%. Every temple, every Mormon temple that is on this planet has the stuff going on in it. However,
yes,
there are also private home locations. There are also other churches that are utilized to do this. There are buildings that are owned by church officials or church attendees that are donating time there because they're part of this group. So, I mean, it can be anywhere.
That's why it's interesting that a temple was just opened at Rome.
That's so suspect. I can't even tell you. Yeah. I mean, the fact that all 15 high general authorities went over to Rome for a temple dedication, that's never happened. That was baffling. I mean, I've never seen that happen before. They never, all 15 of leaders of the Mormon Church never go anywhere together in mass like that. They never travel together and end up out of country together like that. So for all 15 people to be, all 15 men to be in Rome for the dedication of that temple it's highly suspect to me. I mean, I know what's going on over there, and the fact that, Russell Nelson and the Pope are meeting, it's like, well, to me, that's not hard to connect dots, especially after what my friend had told me about her experience with, the cardinals and
probably
and
all Vatican. All the six,
yeah.
Yes. Now, I'd like to ask you a little bit more to describe the drug testing protocols. You said it occurred in a certain building in Salt Lake City, and what exactly happened to you?
It was set up as a fairly clean testing facility. I want to say a medical facility, but it was white. There were medical tables. I was often in like a hospital gown, and being taken into these rooms. In the cases that I remember, it was always individualized. I wasn't in a room with another child or another person. So they wanted to monitor, my reaction based on just having it be controlled the way it was. And they did that. There were many rooms that they did this. But so in that case, it depended on really what they were trying to do. But it was mainly, from what I was gathering, it was a lot of testing that was being done before or in accordance with Big Pharma. So, I mean, understanding that at that time I had no idea what Big Pharma was, but being able to, as I look at what the church has a lot of their holdings and their investments and their stocks in, I was told once that they've got over 33% of their holdings are in stock in Big Pharma. And I think it might be even more than that. But I do know that there's a lot of the stuff that was done at the time frame that I was being tested on is in effect now. So I know that in my experience, I mean, they work a lot with what they referred a lot to the testing that was done the Nazis were doing. And I was even given some drugs that I later learned was what they were giving to, Nazis were testing on Jews. And so it was still a continuation of that kind
right.
of testing.
Well, clearly that's established. Yeah, the Nazis were brought over for that reason after the war, to
mm-hmm.
continue the drug
Absolutely.
And mind control.
Right, and so much mind control is going on. I mean, it's incredible, mind control that is constantly being, the members of the Mormon Church are being barraged with. And, I got to tell you, they're really, really arrogant, but I was also recalling some of the motive that they were testing, what they were trying to do. It's not just the drugs, but you have to be drugged. You're going to be, your state of mind, I know, is really important. So even if I was just coming off drugs, I wasn't fully conscious. The reality that they set up for me was the reality that I was going to be my belief system. That was going to be easy for them to manipulate. And so based on the light and the sound and my brain's ability to receive the information and to assimilate it into my own reality is really what they were always, and they currently right. are focused on. So
interesting, because these are classic techniques used in mind control experiments, creating euphoria when you're looking at horror, you know, creating mm-hmm. that situation. And you also had an experience where I believe it happened in the Madeleine Roman Catholic Cathedral, where you felt mm-hmm. that the life was actually being sucked out of you by this man and woman. Could you talk a little bit about that, and what do you think that represented?
Oh, so, well, yeah, I mean, what I was being told what that represented. They, basically, the whole condition around that was I was on a table. They'd put a needle in my arm, and it was the drug in this case was a paralyzing drug. So my extremities, I couldn't move my... Like, I couldn't move my body. And in the meantime, I was also being, I was also kind of losing consciousness enough so that I could hear what was being said, but they were basically saying, we can take your life and notice how we are taking your life. We control you, so we can kill you if we want to. And so as I was feeling that I couldn't move, and as they were, you know, challenging me to move, like, try and do it. See if you can do this. Move your hand. Try this. Grab this, you know, grab this item from us or whatever. Right. And as I was losing consciousness, all of that was going, and I was being told that the life was being sucked out of me. And you know, it's really funny because, not funny, but part of the conditioning behind that is even to have audible things. So if you're going to have, like, audibly, there would be like maybe a sucking sound, because it would be that would be associated with the life being sucked out of me. So the words and the sounds and all of that were going on. So I was really getting down into a nothingness, and I began to feel, you know, a warmth going through my body, which was another drug that was administered, so I could feel it moving through my body. And then it was followed by cold, because they were telling me that this is what was going on and this is the process of death. And then just as I thought, you know, and they were telling me, you know, you are dying, you will be dead soon, within moments, within minutes, they were giving me time frames. Right then, I was told, or we can bring, you know, we can make you live. And then that adrenaline was shot into me, and my entire system got jarred by that particular experience. So then, excruciatingly, painfully, all of my senses were just, like, jarred back into the reality. In addition to that, though, I was also hooked up to electrodes, so there was electrical shock that was also timed with it, so that my entire system had gone from this, I'm dying, into I am now suddenly alive and awake, but it was painful, like just ridiculously painful. And that's when they said, you know, and we can, you know, and we give you life. This is like, they are God. So
now,
I was,
Deborah,
given life again.
You said that this occurred in the basement of the Cathedral of the Madeleine, the Catholic Cathedral in Salt Lake City. How did you know it was occurring there, and how many people were doing this to you? Like, who were they?
Well, this particular, I don't know who they were. I know in this particular situation, there was just a man and a woman. I know that there was, there's a number of different rooms down in that basement, and gosh, it looks a lot like, at the time, there's a level there that looks like dungeons, like really dark old medieval dungeons. And so it wasn't like the clean white testing room that was, you know, any other place. So this particular situation was basically basically focused on conforming and don't disobey, because we own you. We own your life, you know, and stay in line here. And that's not the only place that kind of a situation happened. That's a very common conditioning. But in that particular situation, in that case, it was pretty extreme. There is a lot of brainwashing techniques that are used, shock treatment all the time, shock treatment's even used to, at least on me, was used to help me discern when God was talking to me. And so there's, in the Mormon church, there is a scripture that's referred to a lot where you'll have a, when God talks to you, if you're going to pray and you're going to ask, you're going to have a burning in your bosom, or you're going to have this, a tingling sensation. Basically, you're going to know if your answer is from God if you have these visceral experiences. And so they really focus on and exploit that. So there's been a number of times that, electrodes and heat packs have been put on my chest, and it is like something in front of me. I have to make a decision if it's going to live or die. And I get this burning sensation in my chest, and it's kind of like, well, the answer is yes. And so then I watch it die because God has now willed that. Oh, that's not the case, but it's a conditioned thing where I'm seeing that, this is the kind of power that God has, And then in addition, it's like, well, and now I got the tingling sensation that goes up and down my spine saying, yeah, this is God speaking again. This is what God wants. This is God's will.
Now, Deborah, if we could just step back for a minute. When people first hear this, they find it very hard to relate this to church life. There's a whole mm-hmm. kind of church life that people are believe is the sum total of what a church is, when in fact, all of these crimes, and we know from experience, evidence over many years, all of these crimes go on within the church, as part of the church, the highest leadership level of the church. Now, in terms of the Mormon, in your experience with the Mormon church, why does this go on so much? Why is this occurring? What is the relationship of these leaders to the military and Big Pharma and all this that are causing this? Like, why the Mormons?
Well, anything that, I'm going to use the word evil, anything that this group, this cult, this, anything they can infiltrate, they will do it. They're not creators, they're infiltrators. So with the history of the church being as it is, if you want to take it back to Brigham Young and all in this community of people that have decided to go out west, there's really nothing that the U.S. government's doing or can do based on the way things were back in the 1800s. To do much other, much to govern that, there was a really strong establishment that was, of culture and people that was established here. So, it reaches back that far.
Right, so they're like a state unto themselves. They're a power unto themselves, like the Vatican is in Rome. They consider themselves
Correct.
Their own state. So they figure
Correct.
They're God,
right.
they're infallible, and no one can touch them.
Infallible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so then when they have, if since it's already there and it's been there for a long time and it does drive certain aspects, at least it did then, and now it's just being completely overrun by it. But, of course, that kind of infiltration force, that kind of blackness, it just infects everything. It's like a big cancer, and so now it
right.
has just really much overtaken. So it's really not the Mormon Church or the Catholic Church or the government. It's like this deeper commitment to this mafia-like brotherhood that is like,
it spans all those churches,
so
all those countries. It's international. Yeah.
Right. So that's the way it goes.
We've got 8 minutes left till the end of the show. I'm not going to play a final song because this is really important, but I want to tell the listeners that if you're willing, please come back on next week because there's a lot here. We can't do it in one show. And if you're willing, we'll have you on again next week.
You and I can certainly talk about that.
Okay. Great. Anyway, that's an invitation if you're able to do that. I know that mm-hmm. the reason I'm saying that, Deborah, is I've had a number of emails from people asking questions to you, but we don't have the time left on this show for you to...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Wanted to know the process of you leaving the church and how long it took and all that stuff, but that's too much to answer in the next few minutes. But I did want to allow you the next few minutes to say, when you were making references to these ritual killings and everything, it has the whole air of a satanic ritual. Were there robes? Mm-hmm. Was it, that usual thing they do in satanic rituals, like with the Ninth Circle in Europe and elsewhere, that you believe it was going on by Russell Nelson and all
the
leaders?
Black robes. Yeah, they have the same robes. There's black robes, red robes, purple robes, white robes. The robes are always there. The hoods are always there. There's even masks that are there. That's all part of it for sure. So the thing that I really want to emphasize, though, where I feel my stand is, right, and it will be definitely, is the fact is what the goal here, the brainwashing, the drugging, everything that they did, the whole point here was to separate me from myself and to separate me from my belief in God, so that they could insert their own directives there, and I could feel I would exist as an isolated being, but not just an isolated being from my community or my family or anything. I was being systematically isolated from myself. I felt disconnected. I was fractured. I was away. And so when a person is that isolated, they are so easy to control. The fear, the worry, whatever it is that, you know, your belief is, suddenly that's when you start controlling entire nations. That's the goal. If you can get people to feel isolated, feel alone, and feel like nobody understands them, not even their God understands them, that is a very dangerous place. That is not natural to us. That is not natural to who we are as a sovereign being and as an enlightened being, as a human being, right? So what I want to say is, let's, my goal, my desire, my focus is to have us as communities really look at ourselves and how we can be our own best friend, and then how we can unify. Let's look at unification, not separation. I mean, there is this being called Jesus Christ. Some believe he is the Son of God. Some believe he was a prophet. Some believe that he was just a guy that walked the church, the earth. And instead of spending time and trying to decide who he really was, let's agree that he's here. Let's honor the belief of who he is to you, and know that this is he's a representation of good. Let's just go there, get over the fact that we have to convince anybody of our own belief in who this person is, and let's see how we can bring ourselves together. And how we can bring all of that in a powerful way.
We have a common ground that goes beyond all religion and everything. It's our common humanity, and that's the basis of common law and everything we do. That's really the basis of unity for all this. And you said it so perfectly just now, Deborah. And I do, when you do come back, I hope you can talk as well about how you overcame this, the struggle and the methods you used to overcome this, and what you want to do today in terms of uniting others, helping others leave this criminal body, and the kind of things we say to people in the Catholic Church, that, you know, you can practice your faith, but you don't have to be part of a murderous organization to do it. And
absolutely not, yes.
Yeah. And so I want to thank you, Deborah, today, and for your great courage and love in doing all this. And I hope you'll come back soon. We'll talk about that offline. But do you have anything else you want to share in the next minute?
No, I just want to. I want to thank you for all that you're doing. I believe in a lot of things, and one of it is definitely divine design, and the power of good and light. And I just really appreciate the courage that you have and the risks that you're taking, and other people in their own silent ways, of really staying true to themselves, but raising that vibration and, you know, exhibiting their own courage. I just am astounded by really the power of the human soul, and I'm just moved. I'm moved by it, and I appreciate all of this. I really do. So thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Well, we do it together. And thank you for us today. We'll talk to you again real soon. Thank you, Deborah.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Bye bye.
Bye for now. Very brave woman, Deborah. She'll be with us again soon, hopefully. Now, listening today, folks, if this doesn't move you to take action against criminal churches, the Satan in sheep's clothing that's causing the death of these innocent children, if this doesn't convince you, I don't know what does. And I'll leave it with you and your conscience. Don't ask me what to do next. Your conscience will tell you what to do next. Get on board with our campaign to take action April 14th to 21st, confronting these churches, these church organizations, their leadership, citizen arrests, leafleting, picketing, demanding the government cancel the tax exemptions. Do you really want to financially endorse these murders going on? Because that's what you're doing as we speak through your tax money. It's important you get on board with this campaign. Go to murderbydecree.com, thecommonland@gmail.com. Read our books, amazon.com, Kevin Annett. That's how you can start getting educated and take action. Now, until next week, stay strong, stay clear. Contact us. You know what you have to do. Until next week, carry it on.
Silent soldiers on a silver screen, framed in fantasies and drugged in dreams, unpaid actors of the mist.